content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled An Artist for the Here and Now by Jay Cheshis. Long overlooked, Swedish painter Hilma af Klint made pioneering abstract art. Today, she's a global star, but some scholars insist she should be sharing the spotlight. In February 2013, the Moderna Museet, Stockholm's National Museum of Modern Art, opened a blockbuster show, Hilma af Klint, a pioneer of abstraction. Heralding a then obscure Swedish artist, a woman, a mystic, who painted at the turn of the 20th century, believing her art carried spiritual messages that would benefit humankind, af Klint worked with non-figurative forms years before her male peers, Vasily Kandinsky, Piet Mondrian, and Kazimir Malevich, were credited with inventing abstract art. In Stockholm, the show shattered the museum's attendance records, and it eventually attracted more than 1 million visitors as it toured museums across Europe. Now, 81 years after her death, this once-overlooked Swedish artist, her work barely shown in her lifetime, has become a posthumous global sensation and her country's biggest art export. One should not overestimate how unbelievably unknown she was, Daniel Birnbaum, the former director of the Moderna Museet, who helped organize the show, told me in Stockholm recently. In the years since the Moderna Museet show, the booming interest in af Klint's life and work has been dizzying. A feature film, Hilma, by acclaimed director Lasse Hallström, a comprehensive biography by the German art historian Julia Voss, a couple of operas, a children's picture book, a historical novel, The Friday Night Club, even a comic book, The Five Lives of Hilma af Klint. An immersive af Klint virtual reality experience debuted in London 3 years ago, followed by a sale of unique digital reproductions known as NFTs that were backed by pop star Pharrell Williams. Cheap posters of her most recognizable works have become big sellers online. In addition to challenging the long-established story of the birth of abstract art, af Klint has become a cultural force, touted as an early feminist, a queer icon, a prophet, a witch, whatever your worldview wishes for her to be. There are millions of younger artists who adore her, Birnbaum says. You can almost say there's a Hilma af Klint school now. And since 2013, her work has been perpetually on tour. The Moderna Museet show traveled to Denmark, Norway, Germany, Estonia, and Spain. In 2018, af Klint's work reached New York with a large survey, Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future, filling the rotunda at the Guggenheim Museum, once again breaking attendance records and further cementing her status as an international art star. I very much felt that our ideas about abstraction needed to be more expansive than they were, Tracy Bashkoff, the show's lead curator, told me. Last fall, a sequel, even more comprehensive, with 220 artworks, opened at the Guggenheim's outpost in Bilbao, Spain. Much of that work traveled to Japan this spring for af Klint's first major show in Asia, on view at Tokyo's National Museum of Modern Art through mid-June. This spring, she also makes her solo debut at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, with Hilma af Klint, What Stands Behind the Flowers. The title is taken from a line in her notebooks, and the exhibition showcases a portfolio of 46 botanical drawings completed between 1919 and 1920, close studies of plant life mixed with diagrammatic abstractions, never shown publicly, that were purchased from a private collection 3 years ago. We realized her story is an interesting one, says Jody Hauptmann, the show's chief curator, of MoMA's decision to spotlight her work. She brings up all sorts of other narratives of abstraction that have to do with interest in alternative spiritualities and the intersection of spirit and science. But Off Clint might have just as easily faded into obscurity, her work forgotten, her spiritual messages dismissed as a crank's. For decades after her death, in 1944, some in the art world certainly viewed her that way. In 1986, a few of her pieces found their way into a group show called The Spiritual in Art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, shown alongside her contemporaries Mondrian and Kandinsky. Though Off Clint almost certainly knew of their work, it's unlikely they knew of hers. Reviewing the show at the time, the critic Hilton Kramer dismissed her as, quote, simply not an artist in their class, end quote. Now, her posthumous fame has unleashed a tangled knot of conflicting artistic, financial, cultural, and personal interests that threatens to overshadow the work itself. A bitter battle is underway for control of the Hilma Off Clint Foundation, which was founded 53 years ago to safeguard her legacy and possesses nearly her entire esoteric output, opening a litigious rift over who has the right to show her work, who should see it, and who should benefit from what she left behind. And new materials unearthed recently about Off Clint's wider spiritual circle, as well as new information found sifting through her own prodigious writings, have begun to challenge established narratives about who made the work. Was Hilma Off Clint a singular visionary, alone with her thoughts, as early biographers wrote? Or has she mistakenly credited with the achievements of a collective of women, sharing ideas and creative output in search of enlightenment? Off Clint was born in 1862 into an affluent, noble Swedish family with a nautical lineage. Both her father and grandfather were high-ranking officers in the Swedish Navy. Off Clint and her three siblings, a fourth had died in infancy before Hilma was born, were raised in Stockholm, and they spent their summers on the family's pastoral estate on the island of Adelso, west of the city. As a young woman, she showed a natural affinity for art. After taking classes at Stockholm's technical school, at 19 she secured a spot at the Royal Swedish Academy of Fine Arts, among the first art schools in Europe to admit women full-time. It was a period of cultural, scientific, and political upheaval as the turn of the 20th century approached. Across Sweden, women were starting to chart their own path in life, and a fascination with the occult was brewing in the upper echelons of Swedish society. Off Clint began dabbling in seances even before art school, communing with the spiritual world while grappling with the devastating loss of her younger sister, Hermina, who died suddenly at 10 years old in 1880. After graduation from art school, Off Clint found work painting conventional portraits and landscapes. And with her classmate Anna Castle, the daughter of a wealthy industrialist, in 1896 she joined the Edelweiss Society, a women's spiritualist group that gathered regularly to conduct seances. Off Clint, Castle, and three other members, an experienced medium, Sigrid Hedman, and sisters Mathilde Nielsen and Cornelia Cederberg, soon broke off to form their own splinter group, the Five, as they called themselves. Meeting weekly in each other's homes, Off Clint and her friends used a psychograph, a strange new device said to enhance psychic powers to help them communicate with spirits. Messages arrived in words, written in collective notebooks, and in images delivered as automatic drawings, their hands guided by the spirits they believed, creating jerky, jagged, non-representational forms that they all signed as a group. They heard from a regular collection of voices, the High Ones, as Voss describes them in Hilma Off Clint biography, first published in German 5 years ago, were spirits from distant times and exotic places, including Ananda, who shared the name of the Buddha's closest disciple, and the medieval priest Gregor, who seemed locked in an eternal battle against heresy in the Catholic Church. New esoteric spiritual movements had begun sweeping across Europe. Off Clint and Castle found their way to Theosophy, which mixed Eastern and Western spiritual thought, and later followed Austrian guru Rudolf Steiner to its more Christian offshoot, Anthroposophy, which he founded in 1912. Off Clint kept a meticulous record of her spiritual journey in what would grow to thousands of pages of handwritten notebooks. Though the Five continued to meet as a group, Off Clint also heard voices on her own. The spirits, she believed, had been reaching out to her directly since the 1890s, and they told her to paint. She recorded one such message in 1907. Take your palette and begin. Expect a surprise. Strange forms poured out of her. Big looping flowers, organic spirals, cubes of contrasting primary colors. By 1915, she had completed a whole body of work. 193 otherworldly paintings in a mix of abstract, symbolistic, and figurative forms, all done in series. Primordial Chaos, Eros, Evolution. Among other cycles exploring metaphysical themes. The most monumental pieces, simply called the Ten Largest, were dramatic tempera pigment works on paper, more than 10 feet tall, and have been completed in a frenzied 9-week period in 1907. Although the collection formed what became to known as the Paintings for the Temple. She dreamed of a physical space, a temple, that would one day house her art, and she sketched plans in her notebooks, even pinpointing potential locations. In her mind, the paintings were more religious icons than classic artworks, carrying sacred messages and were commissions, she wrote, from the quote-unquote astral plane. Ulf Wagner, an artist and art historian who oversees the Hilma af Klint Foundation's archive, told me, "Not one of these paintings is signed, because from her point of view it is not art, it is something else." Every shape, every color seemed to have a secret meaning, but in her notebooks, her writing often as portentous as scripture. Even af Klint didn't seem to fully understand what story they told. By the time she completed the paintings for the temple, she had developed a fixation with Steiner, seeking his spiritual guidance and constant approval. She hoped he might eventually help her decipher her work. And increasingly convinced of her prophetic gifts, she eventually widened the circle of women around her to 13. That number had significance. "The collective soul is a conglomeration of several souls," she wrote in her notebooks. "When such a conglomeration has reached a certain stage, its task is to send the strongest of the group to Earth, the one we call the 13th. Many of the women played a role in her artistic creations. They prayed, they had seances, they had love affairs, they did many things together," Birnbaum said. "But she was the motor behind the painterly project. That's what I believe." But operating outside the art world, af Klint struggled to find a wider audience for her work among either art lovers or spiritual believers. Upon her death in 1944, childless and never married, she left behind some 1,300 works of art and a mountain of writing, 26,000 notebook pages. These were bequeathed to her nephew Erik af Klint, a vice admiral in the Swedish Navy. She came to believe that future generations might one day grasp the work. According to Voss, she indicated in her notebooks that many of her cherished works should be locked away until 20 years after her death. True to her wishes, this remarkable trove remained hidden for decades. The art had been collected from her last studio on the island of Monroe, just across a narrow strait from Adelso, then rolled up in crates and stored in an attic atop an apartment building in central Stockholm where Erik moved with his family after the war. One day in 1966, accompanied by his youngest son, Johan, he finally began to unspool and photograph his Aunt Hilma's work. He'd hoped he'd find a permanent home for it in a Swedish museum, but at every institution he visited, beginning with the Moderna Museet, he was roundly dismissed. In those days, it was taboo to talk about spiritual and painting, Johan, now 85 and retired from a career in finance, told me one morning last fall at the dining table of his antiques-filled Stockholm apartment. Johan honed his sharp English diction living abroad in New York, California, London, and Southeast Asia, where he picked up an abiding interest in Buddhism. On the walls of his apartment hung paintings of old sailing ships, along with some of af Klint's more conventional art. Coastal landscapes, a portrait of a young boy, each painted in oils before her psychic visions began to radically reshape her work. In 1972, frustrated by museums' rejections, Johan's father, Erik, launched the Hilma af Klint Foundation, donating her entire oeuvre to the organization, hoping it would keep the work safe. Johan took over as chair in 2011, when preparations for the Moderna Museet show, which would audaciously reframe af Klint as an artist of world historical importance, were just beginning. The museum had early snubbed an offer of a huge af Klint bequest, but had begun to see her work in a new light, responding to broad cultural shifts in the historically male-centered art world. even before planning the show, the institution had been maneuvering for more gender parity in its permanent collection. In retrospect, Birnbaum told me, the Off-Clint show's subtitle, A Pioneer of Abstraction, was always intended to provoke. She's not only abstract, he said. There are moments when there's no other word for it, but it was never the end game. I mean, she invented, or at least discovered, abstraction as a possibility and a more complex way to work. As a painter, Off-Clint came of age just as a rush of new artistic movements were emerging in Europe. As post-impressionism mixed with Art Nouveau, and Cubism and Fauvism were producing avant-garde art stars. Norwegian expressionist Edvard Munch showed his work in Stockholm, rising to prominence just as Off-Klimt began finding her own artistic voice. She was surely aware of the broader cultural context, according to Voss, her biographer, but she kept the art world at arm's length, focusing her efforts on reaching a spiritual audience. When some of the paintings for the temple traveled to London in 1928, it wasn't for a gallery or museum show, but for the World Conference on Spiritual Science, organized by the English Anthroposophical Society. Working in relative isolation, she produced an oft-bewildering body of work, laden with symbolism endlessly open to interpretation. Off-Clint's real intentions remain elusive, buried in the labyrinth of her elliptical writing. It's very hard reading, says Johan of her notebooks. It's not a straight line where you come to a conclusion. She writes in circles. And there's little personal context to frame her spiritual writing. Off-Clint edited her notebooks later in life, rewriting or destroying entire passages and exercising biographical details. In 1930, she took away everything that has to do with her in the notebooks, Johan says. So we in the later generations have a hard time finding out who she was. Johan says he remembers meeting his great aunt a few times as a child. She left him a mission, he claims, 2 years before her death when he was just 3 years old. She gave us a task, my brother and me, that when you grow up, you should protect my work and you should also disclose unreliability around the works, people you can't rely on, he said. He'd be doing his best to honor that commitment by working with other family members to unleash a flood of litigation and wage a public relations campaign against other members of the Hilma Off-Clint Foundation's board, who he feels seek to profit from his great aunt's intellectual property. For example, the Off-Clints allege that NFTs released by a London-based company, Acute Art, under the creative direction of Birnbaum, were commissioned without the family's consent and in their commercial nature, ran counter to both Hilma Off-Clint's spiritual intent and the interests of the foundation. The works they're based on have been in the public domain since 2014 when copyright protections ran out. Birnbaum, who was on the foundation's board, has stepped down. They now claim that everyone else is taking advantage, he told me. Johan and his allies have also fended off attempts to sell or disperse Off-Clint's work, now worth hundreds of millions of dollars, to private buyers or museums. All of a sudden, people want to come in and grab them, Johan says. And a few years ago, he helped derail plans for a Hilma Off-Clint museum on the Anthroposophical Society compound outside Stockholm, where the Hilma Off-Clint Foundation once stored her art, objecting to the design, location, and mission, and alleging that the museum's main champion, Anders Kumlander, the Swedish Anthroposophical Society's former secretary general, had professionally profited from buying and selling Off-Clint works. Kumlander, who is also a member of the Off-Clint Foundation board, denies any wrongdoing. It's enough with fighting, Kumlander told me. And the battles continue under Johan's 58-year-old nephew, Eric Off-Clint, named after his grandfather, a medical doctor and Christian preacher who heads the board today. Johan and Eric have been allies on the legal front, but they have different views of Off-Clint's art. Johan picks up on Buddhist symbolism in the work, as filtered through Theosophy's Eastern influences, while Eric sees biblical themes. Off-Clint's notebooks cover a broad spectrum of spiritual thought. If you know the Bible, you can understand her art, Eric insisted when I met him one morning over coffee and cardamom cake in his spare, almost monastic apartment in Stockholm. Eric believes Off-Clint never intended for her paintings for the temple to reach a broad audience. He says his grandfather wrote the foundation statutes to make that clear. The board shall keep the work accessible to those who speak spiritual knowledge, the provision begins. Eric argues that the many museum exhibitions in recent years all violate that intent, and he is working to block future shows. He hopes Ofclint's work will eventually inhabit the temple she dreamed of, open only to true believers. The foundation board should make an effort to show it to the right type of people, he said, of Ofclint's esoteric work. It has to be a spiritual seeker who wants to support what Hilma's spiritual guides were trying to tell her. But Eric is alone on the board in pushing to retroactively lock Ofclint's work down. He seems to recognize this is one battle he's not likely to win. Not even Johan supports the idea. If you don't show the paintings to everyone, how can you influence them? Johan asked me rhetorically. The Foundation's legal infighting provides a sensationalist art world dimension to Ofclint's sudden posthumous fame. But art historians and biographers are at least as swept up in the revelations emerging from what is essentially the brand new field of Hilma Ofclint's studies, as scholars get to work digging through a mountain of previously neglected historical materials. 4 years ago, for instance, Kurt Almquist, an independent scholar and book publisher, found Anna Cassell's journals, some 60 notebooks, in a storage cubby on the Swedish Anthroposophical Society compound. The discovery has opened a dramatic new chapter in the hunt for insights into Ofclint and her universe. Biographers have often portrayed Ofclint as the lone artistic force behind her work. But Almquist, who found Cassell's notebooks in an unmarked box, has another perspective. The difference here is that it's a spiritual group, and it's very explicit that this is a common work, he says. Almquist heads the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit, having married into the industrial dynasty behind it. The private think tank has a broad purview and deep pockets, organizing conferences on art, culture, history, and political thought. His first brush with Ofclint came 12 years ago, when Birnbaum invited him to organize a series of academic seminars tied to the Moderna Museet show. He found himself drawn into the mystique surrounding Ofclint and her work. The pictures are enigmatic, he says. You don't know what they mean. They contain a riddle you have to figure out. Since then, through his family's publishing house, Stolpe, Almquist has overseen an array of books on Ofclint, including a monumental 7-volume catalog, Raison, published 3 years ago. And in 2023, he published Anna Cassell, The Saga of the Rose, a book co-edited with Birnbaum that focuses on Cassell as an independent artist and showcases her own esoteric paintings. Provocatively, the book included an essay, Who Created the Paintings for the Temple?, by Hedvig Martin, a PhD student at the University of Amsterdam, who is completing a thesis on Ofclint and the women around her. Martin argues that Cassell played a much larger role in the creation of Ofclint's sprawling masterpiece than previously not acknowledged. Among other things, she has identified stylistic differences in some paintings attributed to Ofclint that indicate they were in fact painted by Cassell. Ofclint's brushstrokes tended to be more expressive and freeform, for example, while Cassell's were more careful, even meticulous. And Ofclint herself wrote about Cassell's role in the work. The two of us will work out a full series. Our efforts will complement each other, she wrote in 1914. It's not only that Anna Cassell painted some of the paintings for the temple, Martin told me, but in almost every series, there are several women working with Hilma. We don't know if they were assistants or were working independently, because the notebooks didn't reveal that much. But the narrative used to be that Hilma worked alone against all odds. The material has raised new questions about attribution in museum circles, though Ofclint is still widely credited as sole author of the works. Hauptmann, the curator of MoMA's upcoming show, told me, to me, it only makes it more interesting that these women were working together. It doesn't lessen the work. Of course, many celebrated artists across history, from Rembrandt to Warhol, worked collaboratively while retaining the spotlight. It doesn't feel like a conflict, really, Bashkov of the Guggenheim says. It also feels a little like, if this were a man, we wouldn't really be talking about this. The lone creator is a myth that goes back a long time in art history. It doesn't shake me to the core. For his part, Johan Ofclint agrees that Cassell may have played a role in creating Ofclint's work, but he believes Almquist's book goes too far. He argues that Cassell was not with Ofclint during most of the period when the paintings for the temple were made. She was with Hilma the first year, Johan said. Then she came back in 1912 or 1913, 5 or so years later, and started to try painting as Hilma did. Of course, Anna Cassell should be recognized for what she is. I have no problem with that. Almquist is now completing a new book based on a close reading of Offclint's writing and Cassell's, exploring themes found in both women's notebooks, including discussions of sexuality that were progressive for the time. For example, Offclint wrote about gender duality, the twin soul, and feeling like a man in a woman's body. You can start to compare, he says. What is the difference in their perspectives at the same time period? Offclint and Cassell seem to have a complicated relationship. The best of friends in their 20s, perhaps more than that, they remain close throughout their lifetimes, even after tensions and disappointments, including a dispute about financing for Offclint's studio. In her notebooks, Offclint recorded conversations with Cassell and other women in her spiritual orbit that she said took place after their deaths. She refused to let them go because they're karmically tied to one another, Almquist said. And we are going to pause on that article because I won't be able to finish it on today's program. And we'll finish this today's program with an article from Origins in the prologue section. And then we'll finish that article on next program. You are text, the genesis of an informal medium that took over our vernacular. On December 3rd, 1992, in Newbury, England, computer scientist Neil Papworth texted two words, Merry Christmas, to Richard Jarvis, a Vodafone engineering director, who was across town at a Christmas party. The simple holiday greeting between colleagues was, in fact, a landmark event in the history of telecommunications. Papworth had just sent the first text message. Texting in the broadest sense, that is, electrically sending words back and forth between people, has arguably been around for nearly 150 years, since Samuel F.B. Morse unveiled his telegraph. But on that wintry English eve, texting began its journey to the heart of our daily experience. Of course, phones still had to catch up. The device Papworth used, the Orbitel 901, an early mobile phone, was a blockish and unlovely LCD screen, was a behemoth, a corded clunker that more closely resembled a contemporary landline than a modern cell phone. In a way, we've been waiting for SMS, or short message service, the form of texting that Papworth introduced, since Donald Murray added a typewriter keyboard to the telegraph around 1901 to create the teletype machine, which transmitted messages over electrical lines for a small fee, usually at a telegraph or post office. The telex service, which operated over telephone lines, was in operation in Germany as early as 1927 and spread globally in the years after World War II. Telex fell out of favor by the 1970s as fax machines rose in popularity, followed by early computer email systems. As the decades went along, we inched closer and closer to uninhibited electronical text messaging, a day Thomas Edison had foreseen with remarkable accuracy in as early as 1878. In the future, Edison wrote in an essay, "Everyday people would send voice messages back and forth using his phonograph in tandem with the newly invented telephone. The dictation may be as rapid as the thoughts can be formed or the lips can utter them. It was a vision of leisure, offering the ease of letter writing at the speed of the telephone." That blend of casual simplicity came to an apex in text messaging. Today, the pinnacle of convenience is immediate yet asynchronous communication, sending a message when you're available and waiting for the recipient to respond whenever they can. In recent years, the rise of voice notes transmissible by text have arguably brought us even closer to Edison's original prediction. Meanwhile, text shorthand continues to overrun our vernacular, TTYL. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. Wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.